Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Monday, April 22nd. I'm Hannah Floor. Alaska's Division of Forestry released its plan for selling timber in Southeast Alaska for the next 5 years. The plan seeks to turn some old-growth stands into areas that can be harvested repeatedly in the decades to come. The state will seek public input. But as Angela Denning reports, an environmental group in the region is frustrated with the public process.
The state has identified about 4,000 acres of timber that they could potentially sell in the southern southeast region. Most of it is old growth or stands of trees that have never been logged. The state's constitution mandates that the state develop its natural resources on public lands.
We have a tradition of selling timber in this part of the world.
Greg Staunton is the area forester for the state's Division of Forestry.
There's an industry that exists. It's a lot smaller than it has been in the past, but there's a demand for our timber. And we view it from the perspective that it enables commerce to occur.
Most of the proposed sales would be clear-cut. The plan states, quote, "The division believes clear-cutting is a proven and effective silviculture prescription, providing both adequate natural regeneration of harvested areas and an economically practical harvest method," end quote. One proposed sale is 345 acres of old growth from Ketchikan's island, Revillagigedo Island. The location is George Inlet East, about 7 miles east of Ketchikan. Other potential sales include over 1,200 acres of mostly old growth on Petersburg's Midcoff Island in three separate areas. Ideally, the state would like to turn these old growth stands into sustainable young growth that could be harvested every 100 years or so. Staunton says sawmills of different sizes have shown interest in sales in the region. He says there is a public process in place, and they expect to hear feedback on the planned sales from nearby communities.
People recreate, live proximate to some of these areas we're working on. So understanding their perspective is part of what we're doing here.
This state process is so frustrating.
Larry Edwards is with the Alaska Rainforest Defenders based in Sitka.
It's set up so that the public can really have zero influence on what Division of Forestry does. The local communities will have an opportunity to comment on these, but all I got to say is lots of luck.
Edwards says the state has a proven record of not listening to the public. He cites Whale Pass on Prince of Wales Island as an example. The state decided to sell nearly 300 acres of old growth right behind the town, even though most residents opposed it. Edwards says the state's timber sales don't consider enough factors. He says they don't look at the cumulative impacts of losing the older trees in Southeast Alaska, which take hundreds of years to return to old growth status. He says removing old growth changes the character of the land.
No one's looking at how those lands should be managed in the long term. And the impacts to terrestrial wildlife or fish aren't being looked at in a comprehensive way by the state when it's doing these plans.
Environmental groups like Edwards also take issue with the state's plan because over half of the land is not designated for harvesting timber. Some sales are on land that's classified as general use. That designation means the land has the potential for other multiple use activities like recreation.
These are lands that haven't been classified yet for any of those uses. And they're treating them just like any other lands in the Southeast State Forest, which I don't think is legit.
Staunton says the state does listen to residents and communities about their proposed timber sales. He says preparing for and selling the timber sales is a years-long process, and right now, they're just starting.
Our intent is to start looking at these areas in a more focused sense, and that we are interested in information on those sites we've identified.
Edwards says his group will likely comment on the state's Southeast timber sale plan, but adds that he doesn't think it will make much of a difference. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Juneau's emergency warming shelter closed this month, and the city doesn't have a campground for people to move to this year. The shelter housed 63 people at its peak this winter. Clarice Larson has this story from Juneau.
It's the last night of Juneau's emergency warming shelter. But unlike previous years, the people staying here tonight can't move to the city-run campground in the morning. As his partner lies sleeping on a cot in a warehouse along with about 20 others, Mikey says it's hard for the two of them to keep uprooting their lives every day. They've been staying at the shelter after losing their long-term housing this winter.
I carry close to 50 pounds of stuff in my backpack. And he's walking in his walker with three hip surgeries.
Earlier Monday night at City Hall, the Juneau Assembly tabled a plan that would have relocated the city-run campground for people experiencing homelessness to a new location further away from downtown. Instead, there isn't going to be a city-run campground at all, at least for now.
We really don't see a lot of good options, any, frankly, for the campground at this point.
That's Deputy City Manager Robert Barr. He says the cost estimate for preparing the new location came in much higher than expected, and a nearby construction project made it unsuitable. But he said there aren't any other locations that are better. The Assembly's decision means there is no plan in place for a city-run campground unless they can find a suitable location. That could happen this summer, but it's still unclear. Assemblymember Alicia Huskandes says she will be pushing for the city to find a solution that isn't dispersed camping.
I don't think dispersed camping is any kind of solution, so I will be pushing still for us to find something and try to overcome those obstacles.
But many at the shelter will be looking for places to camp. Dave Ringel is the executive director of St. Vincent de Paul's Juneau chapter. He says some shelter patrons have been able to get temporary housing at Juneau's year-round shelters, like the Glory Hall, but others will have to find a public and legal place to sleep in their car or camp for the summer.
We don't have a good campground option. And so, you know, we're going to, you know, quote, camp where you can, which most cities have, and we're going to monitor it.
Ringel says many people are still using the shelter after a cold and stormy winter. Mikey and his partner don't know where they're going to sleep tomorrow. Mikey says he feels abandoned by the city and he doesn't know what people will do.
Take a look at what you're doing to us right now. Where we're going to lay our heads for tomorrow night, we don't know.
Ringel says even if the Assembly finds a suitable location for a new campground, it's still just a stopgap. He says what Juneau really needs is more affordable housing.
Long term, I think we're taking some steps that direction, but in the short term, we've got to keep people alive.
With reporting help from Yvonne Crumry, I'm Clarice Larson in Juneau.
NOAA Fisheries announced last week it will not be implementing new limits on Chinook salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. The national organization that helps manage federal fisheries in Alaska was responding to a January petition from Western Alaska communities asking for a total ban on Chinook bycatch in the large trawl fishery. NOAA regulators said in the statement that, quote, the petition did not meet criteria necessary for emergency action. Subsistence harvests and traditional practices are in jeopardy in many Western Alaska communities, as Chinook salmon returns remain critically low in the region. Most scientists point to climate change and warming oceans as the main culprit, but the pollock fishery is also under scrutiny for the substantial number of salmon incidentally caught in trawl nets while targeting pollock. The pollock fishery currently has a cap on Chinook bycatch, but those asking for stricter limits say the restrictions don't go far enough. Nearly 100 tribes and communities in Western Alaska, including the Association of Village Council Presidents, signed the emergency petition on January 17th. NOAA Fisheries said restricting all Chinook bycatch would effectively close the pollock industry, which is the largest in the nation, as well as one of the most lucrative. High exposure to lead can be harmful to people, especially babies and children, whose brains and bodies are still developing. In Alaska, fewer children get tested than in other parts of the country. So public health officials with the state are launching new programs to encourage testing and learn more about lead poisoning in Alaska. Rachel Cassandra has the story.
Kaylee is playing with her four-month-old daughter, who's nicknamed Bun or Bunnick, the Inupiaq word for daughter. We're not using Kaylee's last name to protect her family's privacy. Bunnick is just starting to learn how to roll over from her tummy to her back. Her doctor says she's right on track developmentally, But that's not something Kaylee takes for granted. When she first got pregnant, she had been working at a metals mine in Alaska for 2 years.
That's what made me realize I should check my lead levels and be more careful about that.
When her job tested her, Kaylee's blood levels of lead were over 6 micrograms per deciliter. That's almost twice what's considered high by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She says her midwife consulted with a health expert in Seattle because she didn't have enough experience with prenatal lead exposure.
When I first realized that the lead levels could be concerning, I was pretty scared. I was really scared when the midwife was worried about the lead levels and she was talking to somebody in Seattle.
State epidemiologists say Alaskans can be exposed to lead through many jobs and hobbies, including mining, fishing, and hunting. And while they recommend that all children are screened for lead exposure, only about 10% of kids in Alaska are tested. That's much lower than the national average. So the state is relaunching a working group to coordinate public health efforts around lead exposure. And the Anchorage Health Department is starting a lead testing clinic so families can get connected with help if kids test high. Dr. Michael Savitt is a pediatrician and chief medical officer for the city. He says if lead is in the house, it's easy for young kids to be exposed because they put everything in their mouths.
No lead in the blood is considered normal, but certain levels become concerning. So that's why we're starting a lead clinic so that we can get a handle on the situation.
Kids can be exposed through many things, including old paint, soil, game meat with lead shot, or hunting supplies. Savitt says if families think their child may have been exposed, they should get tested, either at the new clinic or through their healthcare provider.
If mom is the one who has the lead contamination, then it may be passed to the baby in breast milk. But if there's any concern, any consideration that there may have been an exposure, I would urge people to have their blood tested. It's a very simple test.
Savitt says the clinic will test people for lead on site, so the results will be available within about 15 minutes. And he says the clinic can connect anyone with high lead levels to care. Sometimes lead poisoning is asymptomatic, but Savitt says high lead levels can lower kids' IQ and cause behavior and hearing problems.
A child can be irritable, fretful, can complain of headache, abdominal pain. There may be a poor appetite, which would impact growth. It can affect the central nervous system.
Many of the effects of lead poisoning on kids are permanent, but the right care can help reduce lead levels to prevent more harm. Statewide last year, about 4% of Alaskan kids who were tested had high lead levels. Allison Natcher is the state's environmental public health program manager. She says it's important for families to consider ways they could be bringing lead and other contaminants into the house. And she says the state is restarting a multidisciplinary working group to help reduce Alaskans' lead levels. It includes public health nurses, doctors, epidemiologists, and tribal entities.
It's everybody kind of coming together saying we recognize that we need to make improvements and we want kiddos to be safe and healthy, and that also extends to their parents too. We want everyone to be safe and healthy.
If kids get tested and have high lead levels, the Environmental Health Department can work with them to figure out how they're getting exposed. Nadra says good nutrition can help prevent high lead levels by reducing lead absorption.
We recommend consumption of foods rich in iron, calcium, zinc, selenium, fiber, and vitamins B, C, and E, in addition to reducing your sugar intake.
Kaylee, the mother who was working in a mine, couldn't negotiate a position with less lead exposure, so she quit her job a couple of months after testing high. Since then, her lead levels have come down, and last time she was tested, she was within the normal range. Her daughter, Bunnick, is on track developmentally, and Kaylee plans to test Bunnick's lead levels in the future. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
For KFSK, I'm Hannah Flohr.